Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. We're talking about the future of the classical music industry with some great guests. Thank you for joining us.
Hello and welcome to Music Works, a new podcast from Polyphony Arts. I'm Katie Beardsworth and this is the Polyphony Arts team. Margaret Pinder.
Hello there.
And Graziana Prasice.
Hello.
Our vision for our new podcast, Music Works, is to talk openly, honestly, and positively about the future of classical music. And that is what we're going to do. We're going to do that over a series of episodes where we'll have different guests on talking about how their careers have been during lockdown. We're going to have a range of guests over several episodes and we're going to talk about all sorts of things to do with classical music, how it works, how people work within it, and what we can do better and what works brilliantly already. And for today, we are going to introduce ourselves. We'll all be appearing at various points over the series and we're going to discuss the big picture of the future of classical music. So, Margaret, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, hello, I'm Margaret Pinder. I've had quite a varied career. I actually trained as a solicitor and I worked in international shipping and corporate law on Wall Street and in the city where I trained. I've taught at universities. I've been an amateur musician all my life. I'm a double bass player. I'm principal double bass in the Hull Philharmonic Society and I'm on their executive committee. So I've been involved in music making, orchestras all my life, and music is a huge part of my life. And I feel that the work that we're doing here is really important in terms of shaping the industry, responding to the industry, and looking at what the circumstances are at the moment and what an ideal future is for the industry.
Oh, brilliant. And Graziana?
And I agree with everything Margaret said, so my introduction will be much more brief. I'm Graziana Prasice. I'm an Italian pianist. I just completed my PhD in music performance at the University of Hull, and my dissertation explored visual imagery in music listeners. So it's an area which I'm really interested in with both my performances and my research. And I joined Polyphony Arts. It's been around 1 year now. So I think I love the things it stands for, and I do hope things will get better in the music industry with time, especially with what's happening now. So fingers crossed.
Thank you. And I'm Katie Beardsworth, and I founded Polyphony Arts in 2018. It was kind of an accident, to be honest. It wasn't called Polyphony Arts then either. But I have worked in classical music for my whole career, before uni, during uni, and after I graduated, I got my first job as working for an orchestra in London. Subsequently worked as a music administrator in a university and for various other arts organisations. Then when I had my son in 2016 and came back from maternity leave in 2017, I really felt like I wanted to bring something more to my career, which obviously had become so much more complicated with having to juggle childcare and so on. Didn't feel that full-time was for me anymore and so on. So I went freelance, started with a couple of clients who I knew from the work that I'd already been doing, and built it up from there. And I'm incredibly glad that I did. And as we've gathered momentum, we've started to have more and more of an opportunity to say the things that that really matter to us about classical music. And so I'm delighted to be starting this podcast. I will say that I never envisaged having a podcast or doing any kind of public speaking at all. But during lockdown, we started speaking to our colleagues and people that we knew in the industry just as sort of a way of keeping in touch and trying to make sense of what was happening. I think a lot of podcasts have been born of conversations like this in lockdown, and I think it's great to be able to formalise these conversations and to start to look to the future. So we're going to cover The big question, which kind of is going to highlight the theme of the podcast in general, really, is what's going on in classical music at the moment and how does it impact both musicians themselves, artists, and the music organisations that they work for? Is obviously a hugely broad topic, but Graziana, do you want to start by talking a bit about artists and what they're going through at the moment?
I'm sure everyone agrees that this is a very challenging time. I mean, things were challenging already as they were, but this period has been particularly difficult for many musicians. Of course, live performances stopped, and it was encouraging in a way seeing so many musicians moving their music making online, in a way of saying that, you know, we are also here and trying to have their voices heard in a different manner. And I know there has been discussions over whether it's right is not the right word, but whether it's a good thing that so much free content is available online. But I don't think in the long term it can substitute live music in any way. At the same time, I think this is such a good opportunity to start things from fresh as much as we can and really think about how the music industry works, what we can really do to make it better. And this has to come both from the performers, but also from the organizations that have the power to make a change. And I know it's difficult at the moment because they are also the ones suffering, but we really need to start from somewhere. And this is a good opportunity to do that, I think.
I agree completely. I think that looking at the way in which artists as individuals and organizations are suffering, as you said, actually really goes to show the two sides of the problem that classical music does face. And when I say problem, obviously there's lots about classical music that works really well. But I think that lockdown and the pandemic has showed up areas where it is problematic, and actually the things that are problematic are equally problematic for both sides. And what would you say, Margaret, on the organisation side?
Yeah, I think it's been really interesting, actually, because before COVID hit, we were already talking about areas that we saw as problematic within the industry for both performers and the organisations that employ them, just the general structures within the industry. And then, of course, the pandemic hit, and that really just pulled everything to a halt. And I can see clear parallels between what's been happening in the music industry and other conversations that have been happening across other sectors. For example, just economy, how economies work, you know, and discussions about can we actually go back to the structures we had before, because it's really shown up the cracks and the weaknesses. So, for example, I mean, talking about, say, businesses, corporations saying, well, really, there's been a lot of short-term thinking. Short-termism is rewarded. And actually, what we should think going forward, especially because we're looking at, you know, low government, you know, public money going towards bailouts and support, preference should be given to, say, businesses that can show that they have enough sustainability for, say, a year or two, that they are given. So it's actually encouraging long-term, it's encouraging more responsible structures. And I think there's a parallel for music as well, because there are ways in which we were already looking at and sort of picking away at problems within the relationship between the music makers and the music presenters, the music promoters. And I think, again, this is an opportunity for thinking, can we actually redesign that? You know, these were questions that were already out there. In one way, although it's the COVID's obviously been terrible for the music industry, but it does give us an opportunity. It does give us an opportunity to actually revisit those structures and start rebuilding models that are more equitable and more fair and that will actually provide better sustainability.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more. And it's difficult, isn't it, at this time to suddenly, you know, make a switch like that when, you know, it's not the way that you're used to operating. particularly when everyone's upset about things being cancelled and, you know, struggling to understand the impact, and organisations have a really wide variety of access to things like digital support, strategy, planning, you know, so on and so forth. I think that, you know, part of the problem is that music organisations, I'm really thinking specifically of often sort of smaller chamber music clubs here, are often really relying on the expertise and willingness of volunteers to help, which is brilliant in and of itself, but actually it is something that as an organisation, I think you'll agree, we're seeing diminishing, a kind of, you know, one by one, these organisations are finding that they're not able to find the volunteers anymore, or that, you know, sometimes volunteers don't have the skills to deal with the digital age and so on. So that, you know, trying to rethink things at this point, when it's such a shock and everything, can be really difficult. And I really do believe this, having, you know, being so careful and feeling that we never want to be like, lockdown's such a great opportunity, because, you know, there's nothing worse than people who say that. I'm going to say it. Yeah. And it's despicable. But we know that pause for strategic thought is a good thing, and it's probably something that the music industry doesn't have enough of. And actually, I can say that organisations that are more kind of copiously funded have said to me, oh, actually, do you know, it's not that bad to have a year off the festival or whatever, and just to, you know, have a bit of a think. And, you know, that kind of thing completely depends on what's being missed, essentially, doesn't it? But, you know, I do think it's a good time for it. So, you know, hoping this reflection is useful. So what do we think then? I mean, this is essentially the topic of what we're going to do, a sort of open-ended series of broadcasts on. But as a big picture, do we have any suggestions for things that it's useful to be doing at this time in order to prepare for a sort of potentially longer term, socially distanced and, you know, compromised future in terms of what the classical music industry is used to? Graziana, in terms of artists.
It's a big question. And I think what this horrible circumstance created on one side is that people really, although online and not live meetings, but people really started connecting more. And I think there is potential to communicate more with each other and really think how we can make things work. I think we need to think more of as a community rather than my organization, your organization, me as musician, you as musician. I think this is a bigger picture that needs to be considered, because the only way to really change things is if we all stand together for something. So I think communicating with each other is a first step.
I really couldn't agree more. And I have yet to find in my music career an occasion when collaboration wasn't better than competition. That's the best way of putting that. I don't know. But I think collaboration over competition always is a good thing. And I think that is a good thing that's coming out of the way people are responding to lockdown, is that we're seeing more. More of that, which is good. How about you, Margaret?
Yes, now my take on it, I mean, I understand where Graziana's coming from. She's sort of coming from the player's perspective, and I totally sympathise with that. And I think that collaboration, that, you know, the promoters and musicians really have to develop good ways to work together. But I'm more of a political person, and I think one thing that we really need to do more, and this involves collaborating and create a unified voice, and that's political lobbying, actually, because the arts is so dependent on public money, it just is, that I think the arts really, especially music, really has to develop a very strong voice in that field for the people who decide what where money goes and decides on what value arts have. And I'm talking about across the whole of society, in schools, in education, everywhere. And I think that arts, I think theatre is actually one area, because theatre deals with political things all the time. But I don't think musicians are very political people. And I think we need to become more political. I mean political with a small p. I don't mean party political. I just mean, actually, I think we need to actually become more political and have a sense of how to create a unified voice to identify what's needed and be quite clear and bold about asking for it and explaining why it's necessary. So
yeah,
that may not be what you've been expecting, but that's actually, I do feel that very strongly.
I agree as well. And I think we've all discussed between us, haven't we, that, you know, we've all felt certain things about the industry at times and, you know, sort of noticed certain inequalities as to how it works or problems with how it works. But it's only now that we feel moved enough to take a public voice and talk about it. And I do feel that that is the reason for that is because it's been highlighted and that, yeah, the next step is to then point that out to the people that can influence that. And I mean, there are a lot of great efforts and what am I saying, trying to say, Margaret, I don't mean protest, sort of campaigns by yes. by various places like the Musicians Union and Help Musicians to deal with the problem. So it's not to say that that isn't available. But I do agree. I think the more people engage with it, the better. And the better musicians get at expressing the issues. I think we're all terribly grateful for working in such a wonderful industry as musicians and as music professionals. And I think that's lovely. You know, I don't think that we should not feel that. And that's one of the reasons why I've been so slow to ever criticize the industry is because, you know, I chose to work in it and I will always work in it and I love it completely. That doesn't mean I can't see its flaws.
It is, you know, true. Yeah. And I think artists can feel, up to now, they might have felt really that it was something really exposing to express strong opinions like that, like point out what is not working and maybe that will have a negative impact on what maybe I look like or and people might not like it, it might have an impact on my career, but actually it is important to bring that voice out. So it's good, it's nice to see this initiative. I think it woke people up a little bit more to bring them out.
Well, I think as well, the general world has seen how important the arts are. I mean, this is something that is said often on social media, certainly in my social media echo chamber, about how important the arts are in lockdown, what would we have done in lockdown without TV, without radio, without music, without the internet in general, you know, all this entertainment, and yet it's not seen as a priority in terms of funding and support.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that we've noticed is, you know, I'm going back to the sort of theatre music analogy, is that theatre's already kind of won the battle on arguing social relevance and that it can express the voice of the disenfranchised. It can, and that there are wonderful projects that involve disadvantaged children, and it's there. Although there is no funding for art for drama school, and that's been a big thing. That, you know, it means that only kids with money can go to drama school now. Music has suffered from it in that it's very, music has really struggled to shake off that sense that it's somehow elitist, it's for people with money, it's not really accessible, classical music. And yet those of us who've grown up from, you know, in perfectly reasonably ordinary backgrounds, not, you know, I don't think any of us here are particularly privileged, but, you know, we've gone through, you know, having music in schools, experiencing music in youth orchestras with kids who were able to access, you know, reasonable lessons at school, you know, reasonably priced lessons. And I think there's still a battle to be had to show that music is actually not, because that becomes a privileged and elite area, because then it becomes a self-serving argument, doesn't it? Music doesn't need money. It's not important in schools, that it's not really for, you know, primary school kids or kids in difficult state schools. And then it becomes a self-serving argument. So I think there's a battle to be fought on that level as well, before we even get to, you know, that's what I'm saying. There are so many areas where there are quite a lot of political battles to be fought.
The thing with the battle that you're talking about is that if we don't fight that one, there will be nobody to listen to music in the future. There may be people to play music because the privileged will still be able to seek it out if it's really important to them, but there will be nobody listening.
Exactly.
And I think that's, you know, the audiences of the future. I mean, how many, you know, society committees are sitting around scratching their heads and wondering how to get new audiences in. And I say that without being in any way critical of music society committees. I sit on many of them. And, you know, it is a real challenge. And there's the dog. I think that, you know, it's grassroots, the same as anything else. If you don't start at the bottom, then there's nothing really to be going for anything at the top, is there?
No.
I couldn't agree more. Within this, the format of this podcast in future episodes, I particularly think there are three really important sort of parts to the future of classical music. There are almost certainly more, but these are the three that I've come up with. One is future-proofing the industry, essentially, so the audiences and musicians of the future, which at this point boils down to education and the place of the arts in society. It's a small topic there. One is new music and the place that new music plays in kind of concert programming, because I have many, many views about this. And as we represent composers and we work for music organisations that promote as much new music as they can, I know how important it is for new music to move beyond the kind of first performance and to be really integrated into the life of into the repertoire and have a full life, because ultimately all music was new music at one point. And then finally, the industry itself, which is my really big passion, is looking at the way the industry works for people, not the way people work for the industry. And because this all boils down to my personal experience of, you know, having a child and essentially suddenly discovering that the industry that I was working in felt really problematic to me, and I needed a new way of doing it that fitted with my new role as a caregiver, and as someone who perpetually skint. So, you know, this is a problem shared universally, and I think that it's very difficult in a more inclusive world, which we're moving into, it's very difficult to advocate for an industry that excludes so many.
Yeah, can I just go back, pick up on one of the things you said, which is about revisiting, looking at how the industry should work for the people in it, more than possibly the other way around. But I think also one of the things we're looking at, so we're looking at structures and traditional ways of doing things. And as people say, tradition is letting dead people tell you how to live your life. But I think also one of the things we're finding quite exciting, which I think is also part of the debate, is also looking at different ways of bringing music to people. Because obviously with COVID, you know, we've talked a little bit about the online, but also about how we can expand in order to future-proof the industry. We need to look at new ways and ways to bring music to audiences and audiences to music that aren't necessarily in traditional and conventional, the traditional conventional concert hall where you all turn up in your best frock at 7:30 and sit, you know, in respectful silence. I think that's something else that's being challenged. And I think that's something else we've been talking about and looking at that's also quite an interesting part of that debate.
Absolutely. And there's some brilliant work going on in that. I mean, you know, there is some absolutely amazing projects and they can be so, you know, staggeringly effective. And I think, you know, I think classical music is becoming more inclusive like that. But I also think it's quite far behind other art forms in its journey, actually.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is to do with this, the notion of reverential silence, which is just such a problem for like so many people. You know, when you think about how many people would have difficulty sitting in silence for 90 minutes out of the whole of the population, actually, that's really a lot of people, isn't it?
I was going to say it excludes such a big portion of people who could enjoy classical music so much. And one of the most powerful things to watch was where we tried a couple of events where music was in very unexpected places, some chamber music. And it was just so wonderful to see so many people stopping and enjoying it, especially those who never really experienced it. And just because they don't have the chance, or maybe for whatever reason, a concert hall is not suitable for them.
What kind of places were you in?
Well, it was a Hall chamber music collaboration with Absolutely Cultured. So we had musicians on a land train. We had musicians in a shopping mall, in the street. We had anywhere you wouldn't normally expect some classical music to happen. And it was just wonderful to see how many people really enjoyed it and also have the freedom of not having to conform to, oh, I should behave like that. It was just so much more relaxed.
Absolutely.
And I think we need that.
It makes people see it so differently, doesn't it? You know, it can be really difficult to see past, I don't know, dinner jackets and when do I clap and, you know, all these kind of, you know, don't have a suite or, you know, everyone will kill you with their death stare. It's really difficult for people to see past that and just to, you know, people want to be relaxed and when they're doing leisure activities, I think.
Yes. And especially, definitely. But also people with disabilities really struggle with this. Like, my dad has Parkinson's, and the number of times my parents decide not to go to a concert because there's a chance he might move more, he might be noisy, they don't want to be be annoying for other members of the audience for something that is not completely their fault. And what's the content? Like, what are the music venues suitable for them? And all the number of people that have disabilities or for whatever reason.
I mean, reverential silence, sort of the clues in those two words, isn't it? That's not what music is, actually not about silence, really. It's about sound. And it just, you know, reverential silence would be a terrible name for a podcast. It would be a terrible name for a rock band or an ensemble. Oh, yes, we've got a wonderful wind quintet. It's called Reverential Silence. And it kind of just undermines that whole active dynamic between the audience and the performer. And that active, engaged, developing relationship. Even if the audience is quiet, they're not silent in the sense of passive and receptive. So, yeah, it's all those kind of things that there are some really fantastic conversations happening about that as well. And I think that's something we're going to have a really good time looking at and talking about.
Definitely. I couldn't agree more. My story about reverential silence is always so... my dad, who's 81 and has also worked in music all his life, isn't the greatest at staying still when he listens to music. He has a tendency to get involved in the conducting. in an utterly, you know, why would we ever not move to music when we hear it and it moves us to do so? And I was at a concert once and he was doing his, I mean, he really wasn't being disruptive. You know, he was just shuffling a bit and he gets very emotional because it's a whole lifetime's worth of emotion and feelings about music and work and so on. And I completely understand that. He was shuffling about a bit, clearly, I guess, and somebody tapped me on the shoulder, because obviously you wouldn't tap an 81-year-old man on the shoulder and tell them not to move in a concert, would you? Because, you know, that would be a whole other social barrier to overcome. So I got tapped on the shoulder and shushed, which, frankly, I just thought was really funny. But had I been anybody else, you know, less involved in music, or actually had I even just been me but a few years earlier, I would have been really put off by that, especially if I'd been the one moving. I know that, you know, in this case I wasn't, but, you know, can you imagine getting called out on you know, enjoying something like that. I mean, I just think that in itself just epitomizes what's wrong with why people yes. don't want to go to concerts. Yeah. Because why would you ever want to go anywhere where someone's going to literally tap you on the shoulder and shush, you know?
Yes.
It's just so rude.
I'm sure there are contexts that, we can enjoy classical music and all the details and enjoy them in silence, but it doesn't mean we need to be robots sat on the chairs. And once I was helping as administrator for a tour, they were playing, I can't remember, but the music was so joyful. And a small child came in front of the stage, not on the stage, but just below the stage, and started dancing. It was the best thing ever. And I was thinking, why isn't everybody doing that? Because it is nice. I mean, we have reactions to music and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yes, at some point as we grow up, we learn that that's not acceptable, don't we, for some completely unknown mm-hmm. reason.
Yeah, that's one reason I love being a double bass player, because it's just about the most physical instrument you can play. So I can really kind of, you know, throw myself about. It's great. And we're bass players, and we do. And if you're a bass player, if anybody gives you the squint eye, you just kind of give it straight back. If I, you want to make something of it?
Not hiding behind the bass there, Margaret.
No.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a nice conversation. Let me, I feel like this is even more of a diversion than it was before, but let me, we've talked a bit about the kind of conundrum that faces classical music, both from a musician point of view and a music organisation or promoter or venue point of view. And I thought actually it might be worth outlining exactly what that means in more detail, because it feels really obvious to me because I'm living it every day. But, you know, that is such is the joy of working in music administration. So here is how I see it. This is kind of pre-COVID. So music is a joy. It is a complete pleasure. And more than just a pleasure, it's almost a calling. In fact, it's utterly a calling. And many, many musicians and composers, performers feel that music just has to come out. You know, it's like if they aren't booked to play music professionally, it doesn't mean they're not going to play. If they are a composer and they have an idea for a work, that work has to happen. You know, they can't just sit on that until somebody commissions it. The result of that is that it has sort of become this this fact that musicians love working in music, and that has somehow translated to, and therefore they shouldn't really be paid very well for it. And again, that's a generalization. It doesn't apply to every element of the industry. Obviously, music has a top tier, as does anything else. But for people starting out, and especially people on the really freelance circuit of like every gig is an individual booking, this is a real challenge, because you get into this situation where you're needing to negotiate your fees individually, and that can depend on your status and your own kind of sense of how you feel about yourself and how you feel about the person you're negotiating with, and just all sorts of things. And we end up with a situation where people are just grateful to be playing, essentially, or grateful to be writing music. This then results in music organisations generally being able to get people to do things for not very much money or no money at all, because the privileged musicians who are out there who have a background of wealth and are able to travel, are able to network, are able to afford instrumental lessons and so on and so forth, are also able to work for free sometimes as a kind of stepping stone into their careers. This seems kind of fair enough in some ways, but actually it causes a lot of problems. So if there's somebody out there that's able to do it for free, that means there are a load of people out there not being paid. And the impact that this has is that organisations don't budget properly for music. And again, there's so many different permeations of this. I don't want to generalise, but, you know, how many times have you heard of a corporate event, say, wanting a dinner dance, and then saying they haven't budgeted for music, but then they're still paying the caterers, they're paying the decorators, you know, they're paying the waiting staff, the front of house, everything, you know, the after dinner speaker, even everybody involved in this event is paid. And then they're like, oh, we'll have some music as an add-on, that'll be lovely. Similarly, and in the chamber music circuit, and we see this all the time because we work heavily in this circuit, we're faced with really serious budgetary restrictions, and these are not the fault of the person who is actually booking the musicians. If they only have £300 to pay someone to come and give a concert, that's not because they themselves have necessarily sat down and gone, it's only worth £300. It's because this whole cycle of music being an enjoyable profession has resulted in, I don't know, ticket fees not being set high enough, ticket sales not being set high enough, or, you know, funding not being sought, or just simply the fact that they know they can actually get someone to do it for £300. Therefore, they don't realise that what they really ought to be paying is like £1,200 or £2,000 or whatever. You know, and really valuing the work and the effort that has gone into that musician learning their craft and perfecting it to a point at which they can entertain a room full of people. And like I say, my aim in talking about this is not to paint anybody as the bad guy and say there's all these evil promoters who like don't value music. I genuinely believe that this is a catch-22 that's caused basically by everyone's love of music. And it's kind of just turned into this real problem. So then the budgets are set low. Then the promoters are faced with the situation where they have to say, we've only got this much, so as much as I can see your value and so on and so forth, this is where we're at. Then the musicians either agree to it or don't, and if they don't, then somebody else does, you know, and because there's always somebody that can afford to do it, and that is the kind of self-perpetuating problem that we face. And this has turned into quite a long speech, but COVID has really shone a light on this. Because musicians are self-employed usually, and in applying for the self-employed help from the government, many, many musicians have fallen through the cracks due to, you know, essentially reasons to do with income.
Yep.
And how it's perceived by the government and how it's, you know, how it's expressed essentially. So it, you know, it's really problematic. And this is the issue that we really want to crack. And I think that if one good thing can come out of COVID for the music industry, sorting out that vicious cycle would be just such an amazing thing.
We're kind of our own worst enemies in a way, but it's one of the great things about music is that people make music from an early age and people value performance, you know, schools, the school concert, everyone dragging granny along and, you know, seeing kids performing, and it's great. So, you know, music societies like the ones we're involved in. So there's as you say, you know, with a lot of volunteers, it's because music is what it is, you know, it does engage a lot of people. And so there's already, by the time you actually hit the professional level at which music's happening commercially and professionally, there's a long history of doing it for free. In the ways that are not, for example, you know, I don't remember there being an oil industry club at school. So, I mean, you know, a club for, you know, nascent oil executives, because that's not how it works. You know, that's not how it works. It's a different thing. So when people go to work in the oil industry, they would expect to be paid for it because there's just no, it doesn't have any other, it is a completely commercial area. And the arts are, you know, you're kind of torn between, you know, the extreme, you know, high excellence and, you know, people who are making a living here and venues and organisations that are running outfits that are meant to, you know, break even, make money, break even, and a huge voluntary sector. And it's trying to kind of differentiate the two and allow the two work together and not, and to understand that there are two different mindsets here and not allow the voluntary and the, you know, music for the sheer joy of it area undermine the sense that it's still something that people deserve to be paid for if that's the area they're working and they're performing in. And too often the one bleeds into the other. And that's why people think, I'll pay the caterers, I'll pay the people who come in to do the flowers, but I can get away with, you know, either not pay the musicians or pay them next to nothing. And I'm sure you found that as well, Graziana. You know what
I'm talking about. There are so many things to say on this. I was speaking once to a musician. It was a friend of a friend, so I didn't know him personally. But we started discussing that he was really struggling at that point, making a living from just playing. He had to do something else on the side as well. And one of the first thing he mentioned, he wasn't a classical musician, I think, but one of the things he mentioned was how badly paid any gigs he was doing were. And I said, but did you consider looking at the musicians' fees and maybe suggest something to the person offering these badly paid jobs? And his response was that if he didn't do that job, then someone else would come and get it for. And that becomes a vicious circle, because we'll just keep going around with badly paid engagements and not really going anywhere. And another moment which I remember being a highlight when I started really thinking about these things. I was working in the music office at the university, and I was in charge at that time of linking any requests for musicians with some of the students studying at the university. And once there was this gentleman asking for a musician and gave a certain fee, which was a modest fee, but I think being in a learning environment, they were the thought it would work. So I got in touch with a very good clarinetist that was studying at the university. And she replied very politely. She said, I'm sorry, but for this fee, I cannot do it, because me and my ensemble, we really stand against underpaid work. She was very, very polite about it. And so unless it is this fee, which is our minimum, I cannot accept it. And I think we really need to be educated on that, especially as students, because you are so used to do it for free, for getting that famous performance experience, which we do need. But then when do you get out of that? You'd have no idea, because you just finish your studies and keep doing it, hoping one day things might change. Now, there are occasions which free work does lead to eventually paid work, and that's where it got a purpose there. But I think we need to understand, to what extent do you keep that going, and at what stage in your career are you keep doing that as well?
Mm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And actually, I mean, there is an amount of performance experience that everyone needs, obviously, but I used to also think that there was a certain value in free work that used to lead to paid work. But the more I go through this job, the more I actually wonder whether the line should be drawn a lot lower, like even pre-graduation, obviously with the exception of, you know, final recitals and that sort of thing. Because actually, unless you know for an actual fact that somebody is coming to this concert that is going to give you work in the future, I really am not sure that I can see the value in doing a free concert in the hope that it'll give you work. Because if anybody knows that you're doing a free concert, you've already set your level, haven't you? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, that is the problem, is that I hear it so often. You wouldn't believe the seniority of some of the people that I know who think that if they go and do something for free, often for like an institution, which is even worse, because, you know, really institutions are dealing with institutional budgets and not, you know, you can sort of understand it if it's for an individual and you know they've only got so much money, you know. Where they'll go, oh, if I go to, for example, this university and do a free lecture, then I might get some lecturing work. And you're like, really? Because it's going to cost them a lot more to give you lecturing work than it is to pay you a one-off fee to do a one-off lecture. So are you really going to get, you know, this is an aside, mm-hmm. something, you know, often musicians do this kind of work as well as, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I basically couldn't agree more with what you're saying. I really feel strongly about people understanding that they can say no without jeopardizing their careers. And I've heard some really horrible stories, which I can't really recount on this because they're probably too close, but in lockdown, of people having gigs cancelled under terrible terms, you know, like really, you know, like no cancellation fees, no proper explanation, no proper kind of we understand how hard this is for you, obviously we have to do it for public health, we'll do it again when we can, you know, just kind of an ignoring and an assumption that things have been cancelled. And I really think there's no excuse for that, because it's absolutely catastrophic for musicians to be treated like that. Do you see? I just think, you know, that if you can't pay, you can at least treat people well.
Yes.
You know.
But don't you think, again, it comes back to the whole culture around how we value the arts as a whole, as a culture, and the culture of how the arts is valued, if you see what I mean, the sort of the both sides of that. Because if the arts are valued in society, then there will be money available for the arts. And the more money there is available for the arts, the more reasonable it is, and the more, well, it's always reasonable, that the more musicians can expect to be paid properly, because there's less sense of, well, everyone's kind of scraping by, you know, by their fingertips. So, you know, we all know money is scarce. It's like, if we know that the arts were properly funded, well, I mean, when are things ever properly funded in terms of what we would like? But if the arts were more appropriately, were better funded, then these kind of conversations would happen less and less. And that's what I'm saying about lobbying, really, really making a voice for valuing the arts in society, because the arts aren't just sitting in reverential silence in a concert hall.
I agree. And this is about the mindset of the whole industry, isn't it? Mm. And the basic mindset of the classical music industry is that there's no money in it. And I would defy anyone to find me a classical musician who has never said that at some point. People always say, and if I wanted to be rich, I'd be a banker, or, you know, whatever. And you just think, really? So you decided you wanted to be poor and you wanted to train for decades, you know, to perfect this incredible skill and talent. And then you just decided to go and make no money from it. But the key thing is that it's not about the individuals. And yes, there are things that individuals can do. They can stand up for themselves. They can say, this is my minimum fee. They can explain the number of rehearsals that it'll take in order for them to deliver this concert, etc. But I think it's a bit unfair to expect an entire systematic change to come to a whole industry from the individuals who are attempting to survive within it. And I think that the organisations have a part to play in this as well. And I say this is working for several of them. And I can also say that, having worked for arts organisations for my entire career, you very rarely feel appropriately funded there either. You often find yourself making more money than the musicians that you're working with, which is another kind of massive unfairness. But, you know, you often find yourself working all hours for a really, and really kind of holding a lot of responsibility as well for a minimal salary. So, you know, the problem doesn't only lie with musicians. So it's in the interest of everybody in the industry, I think, to make this their problem.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's no money in it, said no oil executive ever.
Yeah.
Unless they will possibly talk about green energy, you know. Again, it's coming back to mindset, isn't it? You know, it's one of the things that you'll talk about is mindset.
Absolutely. So anyway, I think that's basically laid out where we're at and what we think. So let's bring our first episode of our podcast to a close. This is very exciting to have done this. Thank you both for joining me.
Hello.
Thank you.
I think it's going to be quite the journey, actually.
Absolutely. We've got some amazing guests coming up as well.
Yeah, certainly the conversations we've been having during lockdown with people from every industry. I mean, that's one of the reasons we're doing this now, isn't it, Katie? Because we've just had such fantastic conversations. We thought this really needs to be brought into a format where we can share these much more widely. So, yes.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for listening today. To find out what we're up to, do join our mailing list or follow us on social media. And if you'd like to support the podcast by buying me a coffee, you can do that on buymeacoffee.com. Thank you so much. See you next time.